Kant lectured on a variety of topics through his career, including logic, metaphysics, and ethics, but also on topics that were not strictly philosophical in the usual sense, including anthropology, education, and geography. And the lecture courses were well attended, they were widely discussed outside of the classroom, and we have many of them today in the form of either student transcripts of the lectures, or sometimes Kant's own notes or manuscripts that he used to deliver those lectures. Now, the lectures on logic, on ethics, on metaphysics have become well-known parts of his complete works and seem to me to be invaluable sources of understanding for a variety of aspects of his better-known writings that he published in his own lifetime. But geography is one that has a slightly more problematic relation to Kant's overall work. But Kant lectured on this a number of times. The most reliable figures suggest that he gave the course 49 times over a 40-year period, from 1756 to 1796. So they span his entire teaching career, and they serve as, I think, an important archaeological register for the lectures, for the material, for the interests that he had in these questions, and chronicle some of the shifts in his thought. Now, the anthropology lectures, which, of course, are better known, are an offshoot of the geography lectures. Initially, Kant lectured on geography alone, and then in later years, lectured on geography in the summer semester and anthropology in the winter. And of course, Kant, late in his life, edited a book out of his anthropology material, the book Anthropology from a Pragmatic Point of View. In 1798, so a few years before Kant's death, he thought a version of the geography lectures was scarcely possible because of his own advanced age, and because the manuscript that he used to lecture was, he said, something that only he could read. But in 1802, shortly before his death, a book claiming to be Immanuel Kant's Physical Geography appeared in print. It was edited by Friedrich Theodor Rinck, and it was claimed to be authorised. And it was rushed into print in part to compete with another book under the title of Immanuel Kant's Physical Geography, which was unauthorised by Kant and was edited by Gottfried Vollmer and was published between 1801 and 1805 in four volumes of seven parts. Now, the Vollmer edition was apparently based on transcripts of lectures from 1778, 1782 and 1793, but was described by Kant, or at least somebody pretending to be Kant, as something that was unauthorised and illegitimate, and he said, "I do not recognise either the material or the arrangement as mine." Well, that's hardly surprising. The material in that book is far more than could ever have been delivered in a single semester, and it certainly mixes up material from a number of different sources. So Rinck's edition, the one that came out in 1802, appeared to have Kant's support, appeared to be an authorised edition, and while both of these, the Rinck and the Vollmer editions, had a wide circulation at the time, it was Rinck's edition that was included into the Academy edition of Kant's complete writings. So the latest volume, potentially the penultimate volume, of the Cambridge edition of the works of Immanuel Kant in translation, includes all of Kant's writings, or all of Kant's key writings, on natural science. And it contains three book-length studies and a variety of shorter texts. The books are Kant's first publication, Thoughts on the True Estimation of Living Forces, from the 1740s, which looks at mechanics and especially Leibniz's contributions to that field. The Universal Natural History and Theory of the Heavens from 1755, and the third book-length study in that natural science volume is The Physical Geography from 1802 in the Rinck edition. And the shorter pieces include reflections on the age of the Earth, on its rotation, on fire and fireballs, on earthquakes, on winds, on the influence of the moon on the weather, on motion and rest, and on the volcanoes on the moon. And many of those shorter texts in the natural science volume relate directly to the geography. Some of them are prospectuses for the course, Kant announcing the lectures that he's been giving in the forthcoming years. Now, the organisation of that natural science volume is straightforwardly chronological. There's a detailed general introduction, then briefer introductions to each selection. And the edition is extremely worthwhile because all of the texts, bar one, the Latin dissertation on fire, have been retranslated for the edition, and the general editor, Eric Watkins, has made sure that these are consistent with each other. And parts of the Physical Geography have been available before, but this is the first full translation of the Physical Geography into English. Now, there are a number of other texts on natural science by Kant that don't appear in that edition because they appear in other volumes of the Cambridge edition. But in sum, that natural science volume gives us the first detailed and most comprehensive edition of Kant's work on this topic in English. So finally, after 200 years, the Physical Geography is available in full in English. but the version translated is the Rink edition, and it is problematic for a range of reasons. And for over a century, people have been working on this question of the problems of the text of the Rink edition. The Rink edition, the best work on this seems to suggest, comprises the introduction from lectures in 1774 or 1775, but the body of the text dates from 1759. So given that Kant continued lecturing on this topic for another 35 years after that, and he continually updated the material in the light of his own reading and in discoveries more generally, we're provided here in the Rink edition and in the New English translation with a text that's terribly out of date. Rink was also what might be called a very active editor. He amended and deleted passages as he saw fit and supplemented Kant's work with his own ideas and reading. And in 1759, period from which the introduction to this text dates, Kant was still lecturing on anthropology within the geography lectures, so that the material here is not necessarily strictly geography in the way that the later Kant came to understood it to be. To put this in relation to Kant's better-known writings, the Critique of Pure Reason dates from 1781. So all the material that we have in the New English Translation and in the Rink edition on geography comes from Kant's so-called pre-critical period, and not the work on the topic he produced later in his life. Now, about a century ago, Eric Adakes was crucial in doing some philological work of trying to work out the bases of these different parts of the lectures as Rink and as Vollmer had put them together. And he'd actually proposed to the Academy edition editors that they should use an alternative text of his devising, drawing on the other extant transcripts of Kant's lectures. But this was apparently rejected on the grounds of cost, because the volume had already been typeset at this time. And for much of the 20th century, it seems that Kant's scholarship didn't really do very much more beyond what Adakes had been working on around these questions. There's one English study of the book by John May. But over the past couple of decades, the historian Werner Stark has been doing crucial work in first discovering, then transcribing, publishing online, and then finally editing into print the different extant versions of Kant's physical geography lectures. And the product of that labour is beginning to be published in German. Volume 26.1 of the Academy edition and the forthcoming volume 26.2. And the material there gives some indication of how Kant's views on this topic related to natural science and geography changed over time. In terms of the questions of space and time, particularly the lecture transcripts show some of the shifts in Kant's own thinking around these questions. And they show something of how his investigations of empirical concerns relates to the development of his critical philosophy. The version that we have in the Natural Science volume, the version in English, makes use of some of Eric Adakes' work in some notes and for variant readings, but it only references Werner Stark's work in a few places. So hopefully the Cambridge edition will include an additional Lectures on Geography volume that can actually make use of some of the work that's now available in German, to make a sample of that work available, as they've done with some of the other material, as they've done particularly with anthropology, which Robert Loudon has been involved in, that volume coming out next year.
It's out already.
It's out already, okay. So what do the lectures do? What's Kant trying to do in the geography lectures? Well, Kant felt that geography and natural science more generally were crucial to his students. They were something that was important for the students to know about. He was one of the first people to lecture on geography as an explicit topic, and this was before it was common to have professors of geography. He had to get special dispensation to use his own materials as the basis for the course, rather than a pre-existing textbook, as he claimed that nothing suitable was available. He nonetheless read very widely and referenced a range of studies in his lectures, including the accounts of a range of his predecessors, including Leibniz, Buffon, Descartes, Newton, and Wolff. The lectures were somewhat of his most attended. The frequency with which he gave them seems to suggest the importance that he put upon them. And initially, it seems they were to provide a scientific basis to the various reports and travel writings that he was reading. But as Holly Wilson suggests in her study, Kant's Pragmatic Anthropology, Kant moved to thinking that the anthropology and the geography lectures taken together would enable his students to become citizens of the world, so that their studies on these topics would enable them to live better lives and would provide the foundation on which the more abstract work of metaphysics, logic, and ethics could be based. So Kant sees these lectures as providing a broad knowledge of the world as a foundation to the more general studies of his students, and that together the physical geography and the pragmatic anthropology, by the time he's lecturing on them separately, they give an empirical grounding to his thought more generally. In a postscript to his 1775 article on the different races of human beings, Kant suggests that the two lecture courses together were Weltkenntnis, so world knowledge, or perhaps, as Holly Wilson suggests, cosmopolitan knowledge and the cosmopolitan philosophy that goes alongside it. So that this knowledge of the world for Kant was integral to the moral and political life of the citizen, the well-rounded citizen that was being educated by him and his colleagues. So both geography and anthropology were taught by Kant because of this pragmatic dimension, the way that this knowledge can guide us in our moral and practical life. And Kant suggests that this is essential to making sense of his other writings. He suggests that physical geography is about the world as an object of external sense and anthropology as an object of inner sense. Kant was also concerned with things that were happening at the time that he was giving the lectures, as the three texts in the Natural Science volume on the Lisbon earthquake of 1755 illustrate. And in the lectures, there's certainly a rich vein of detail. Kant may not have travelled much, but Königsberg, the city he lived in, was a port, and he came into contact with a range of different people, many of whom provided him with material that he used in his lectures. Manfred Kuhn's recent biography is very good on that detail of the kinds of people that Kant came into contact with. Now, Kant was sometimes too gullible in believing what he heard, and that helps to explain some of the more outlandish, fanciful, or at times downright offensive suggestions in the physical geography lectures. Kant understood geography in a particular way. In 1757, he announced in the announcement for his lectures, he suggested that there was a distinction to be made between mathematical geography, political geography, and physical geography. Mathematical geography, for him, envisages the Earth as an approximately spherical heavenly body, void of creatures whose size and shape and the circles projected upon it must be considered. Political geography teaches us about the peoples, the community that people have with one another through their various forms of government, activity and mutual interest, religion, customs, etc. Whereas physical geography merely considers the natural characteristics of the globe and what is on it, the seas, dry land, mountains, rivers, the atmosphere, human beings, animals, plants and minerals. Now the physical geography as a text certainly makes good on that claim, covers all of those things, but it doesn't simply confine itself to the remit. The first part of the text is closest to what might be simply called a physical geography and understood as physical geography today, looking at a range of physical processes concerning earth and water. Kant discusses the oceans, land, islands, the earth and its terrain, earthquakes, volcanoes, electricity, springs and wells, rivers and water, wind currents, climate, the atmosphere and temperature, transformations of the earth and sea. The second part concerns the three realms of nature, fauna, flora and minerals. And these sections are often rather partial, often misleading, the discussion of mermaids being perhaps the most egregious example. The final part of the book, though, is a regional geography of continents and their parts. Now, just before the section on animals, there's a discussion of humans, including geographical and racial differences. And there's more detail in the regional geography part of the text. And this is where some of Kant's most unpleasant views are aired. To take one example, he declares that the nation of the Caribbees, who are mostly distributed in the Antilles and inhabit St. Vincent and Dominique, share the following characteristics. They do not like to be called cannibals and cannot comprehend how one can prefer gold to glass. They never eat salt, are sluggish and cannot withstand violence or hardship, have stubborn whims and an uncommonly great pride. They are never converted to the Christian religion. Their revenge knows no limits. Providence is unknown to them. Their cacique, their chief, has to excel in war, running and swimming. They make little use of the spear, but use arrows with hollow points poisoned with the juice of the manachil tree and clubs. And some related claims can be found in the Universal Natural History book, which is also included in the Natural Science volume. And here too, Kant seems to show the same interest in dubious scientific reasoning, uncritical adoption of other material, and wild speculation that characterises the geography lectures. In particular, he speculates on the inhabitants of Mercury and Venus, suggesting that their bodily constitution is such that they could not dwell on the Earth. In addition, those plants like Earth and Mars are midway in the planetary system, and therefore their inhabitants are balanced, whereas those of Mercury and Venus are stupid, weak, unable to submit to justice, and coarse in body. As David Clark has suggested, this functions as a barely displaced allegory of Europe's close encounters with Africa and other equatorial regions of the universe. Now, we might dismiss the Universal Natural History as an early text, unimportant and tangential to Kant's later writings. but I don't think we can say the same about the geography, which extends until Kant's retirement, and from the available transcripts never ceases to discuss race and racial ideas. Now, Robert Bernasconi, of course, is going to talk about this in a moment, but this argument that he's made, which I find compelling and convincing, that we can't simply see Kant as a product of his time, because Kant goes out of his way to theorise race, to think about it as a category, a scientific concept. He sees humans as part of physical geography and therefore appropriate to these lectures, not just because they're one of the features of the Earth's surface, but also because of their impact on the Earth through their actions, through the cutting down of trees, through the draining of swamps, through the damming of rivers and the like, what people today are calling the notion of the Anthropocene. Now, in the opening sections of the lectures, Kant discusses the remit of geography and its relation to other areas of knowledge. He sees geography as the basis for history, as all events take place somewhere, and that geography works alongside history in terms of perception of things within space and time. As Kant suggests, history and geography extend our knowledge in relation to time and space. Geography concerns phenomena that occur simultaneously in space. So it seems that Kant's means of structuring geographical knowledge transcends some of the more scientific, more problematic scientific errors and the obsolescence of some of his claims. Now, in 2006, Eduardo Mendieta and I had a conversation about Kant's geography. We were interested in why it had been so neglected and thought we might be able to do something about it. Because in the year 2000, the famous geographer David Harvey had taken issue with contemporary thinkers of cosmopolitanism who used Kant as the foundation for their arguments. And Harvey's argument was that Kant's geography meant that those kinds of claims of grounding their cosmopolitanism on Kant were problematic, that his geography was so filled with glaring errors, offensive views, and outdated ideas that their claims of cosmopolitanism today were suspect. He also took issue with the contemporary Kantians who he said had neglected the geography. Harvey noted that many Kantians want to dismiss the work on geography as irrelevant, not to be taken seriously, or that it lacks interest. For Harvey, the content of Kant's geography is nothing short of an intellectual and political embarrassment. Now, when Eduardo and I thought there might be something to be done about this, we thought the two of us covered a number of the key bases. I was trained as a political theorist, had an interest in continental philosophy, and now taught in a geography department. Eduardo was a philosopher with interests in geography and race. But we very quickly realised that the richness and complexity of these lectures required a project of many more hands than simply our own. The texts, the contexts, the content, the relation of the ideas to Kant's work as a whole, and a range of other issues provided, we thought, a number of different positions from which to approach this work. So we thought it's not something we could write on our own or something we could write together, but that we could perhaps find the people that would enable that book to be written. So that it was an edited book, but an edited book that wasn't simply a collection, but really a book by many hands, a book that had a particular purpose of making sense of these lectures. So we had to think about which kind of people might be involved in this. We found in Charles Withers a historian of geographical thought who could situate Kant in relation to his predecessors and contemporaries. And Michael Church, a physical geographer, a fluvial geomorphologist, who would rise to the challenge of situating Kant in relation to his discipline. We invited Olaf Reinhardt, the translator of the geography for the Cambridge Natural Science volume, to be involved. We translated a chapter by Max Marcuse, the French translator of the geography, and we put in touch with Werner Stark, the German editor of the geography lectures. Stark shows in his contribution how corrupt the Rink edition actually is and how it's extremely problematic for any serious study of Kant on these questions. So there is a whole range of philological difficulties that Stark is able to help us with working through and understanding. He talks about the different ways in which, particularly some of the most notorious passages around the theorization of race, are corrupted between what Kant actually wrote and what Rink made of what he wrote in terms of that edition. And we asked some of the key scholars of the anthropology to relate the geography to the anthropology, to those two lecture courses that Kant was giving in alternate semesters. So Holly Wilson and Robert Loudon, who's on the panel today. David Morris related the lectures to Kant's work on teleology and biology. And we asked a number of philosophers with an interest in Kant's spatial thought more generally to contribute, Geoffrey Edwards, Jeff Malpass and Carsten Thiel, and Nora O'Neill. So the essays begin what I think for geography is a valuable project of understanding Kant's geography beyond simply the geography, the text, the physical geography. It seems to me, particularly in geography, what we know of Kant's views of space and the the accounts that Kant offers of space in the geography, while this might sit at odds with the received wisdom in geography of what type of thinker of space Kant was. Kant, it seems to me, in geography is often reduced to a caricature, more often cited than read, although that's true of a lot of work in geography. We believed a careful study of the geography could sit alongside an assessment of Kant's views on geography and in space in his critical philosophy more generally, and his work on the philosophy of history and political history more specifically. So Honora and Neil particularly discusses the idea of orientation in thinking as a geographical way of working in Kant's writings. So Kant's view on space, at least as geographers seem to understand it, is largely shaped by David Harvey's work. Kant, it is generally supposed, held a view of space that was totalizing, based on Cartesian geometry, absolute in the Newtonian sense. So we find a range of adjectival pairings common. Kantian space is apparently Cartesian, it's Newtonian, it's sometimes even more ahistorically Euclidean. And certainly in Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, in the section on the transcendental aesthetic, space and time as pure intuitions, effectively hardwired into our brains, our very way of perceiving the world rather than attributes of it. Space and time are thus the way that we experience forms of sensibility rather than experienced as such. And the relation of this to Descartes and Newton's view of the material world is therefore much more complicated than that of a simple equation. Kant's Critique of Pure Reason and his mature views on space were explicitly directed at challenging a pure Newtonian conception of space. I'm not suggesting by this that this is a view of space that geographers today should adopt, but they should certainly better know what they're arguing against. Kant's earlier writings were indeed closer to a relational view, much influenced by Leibniz, but the critical turn is not entirely against that position. Kant's mature views on space seem to be generally accepted to be first presented in the 1770 inaugural dissertation, and in that he's attempting to mediate between a Leibnizian relative view of space, space is a product of the relations between things, and a Newtonian absolute view, space is the container for things. And the Critique of Pure Reason, I think, is helpful here. Kant suggests that space is an object of outer sense and time of inner sense. It's a relation that's similar to the geography and the anthropology. Space, then, is, as geography, an element of the external world alone, whereas time is both of the external and internal. And Kant poses the questions he wants to address. What are space and time? Are they actual entities? Are they only determinations or relations of things, yet ones that would pertain to them even if they were not intuited, or they are relations that only attach to a form of intuition alone, and thus to the subjective constitution of our mind, without which these predicates could not be ascribed to anything at all? Kant then suggests that space must be understood as a representation, leading him to talk of a representation of space. It's a priori, prior to experience, and the necessary condition of it, the ground of all intuitions, the condition of possibility for appearances, not as a determination dependent on them. In a marginal note, he adds that space is not a concept, but an intuition. It's this sense, then, and in this sense alone, that time is something real, he says, namely the real form of inner intuition. In another note, Kant adds a crucial addition. So is space. This proves here that a reality, consequently also individual intuition, is given, which yet always grounds the reality as a thing. Space and time do not belong to the reality of things, but only to our representations. And in the first edition, the 1781 edition of the Critique, the point about magnitude is important here. Kant claims that space is represented as a given infinite magnitude. A general concept of space can determine nothing in respect to magnitude. In the second edition, 1787, he slightly alters that formulation. Space is represented as an infinite given magnitude, therefore the original representation of space is an a priori intuition, not a concept. And this leads to an important claim, he says. We can accordingly speak of space, extended beings, and so on, only from the human standpoint. And in a separate essay, the one on orientation that Honora O'Neill discusses in the Reading Kant's Geography book, the question of orientation, that is, finding the sunrise in the sky, Kant notes that even with all the objective data of the sky, I orient myself geographically only through a subjective ground of differentiation. So space and time for Kant in this mature period are thus not absolute in anything like a Newtonian sense, and nor does Cartesian geometry tell us about the world as it is. Rather, they're modes of access to the way the world appears to us. Kant therefore concludes in a note to his own edition of this text, space and time, of course, have objective reality, but not for what pertains to things outside of their relation to a faculty of cognition, but rather only in relation to it, and thus to the form of sensibility, hence solely as appearance. Now, several points, I think, come from this. One is that Kant's view of space, and accordingly time, undergoes some important developments, and that we need to be careful in taking claims in and about certain periods as indicative of his thought as a whole. The second is that the geography, physical geography lectures, given over several decades, in part are affected by these shifts. Preliminary investigations of the student transcripts seem to indicate this. The Holstein-Beck manuscript from 1758 to 59 contains no theoretical discussion of space and time in their relation to geography and history. The courses from the mid-1770s have a more extensive introductory discussion, such as the Kahler transcript, which is the basis for the Rink edition introduction, whereas a course from the last year, such as the Volta transcript from 1796, underplays the theoretical material but assumes the essential insights that have been derived from it. Thirdly, I think, and most important, Kant's mature view, the one that emerges in 1770 and is the view of the Critique of Pure Reason, and I think the majority of the geography lectures he gave, is not an absolute view of space on the model of Descartes or Newton. The claim that Kant makes is that space, as his conceptual fiction, offers a way of insight into how we perceive the world and is open to scientific examination, rather than that determination being necessarily representative of space itself. In many places, Kant recognises that directions in space are a product of our bodily encounter with space, rather than the absolute and self-evident determination. Kant is also trying to think about space and time together. Now, he doesn't advance the kind of historical and geographical materialism that somebody like David Harvey or other geographers have put forward, or the spatial history that other geographers, including myself, have suggested. But his separation of space and time and the different ways of access to them through geography and history is a product of theorising, when in practice, either in our experience or in the relation that he continually makes between geography and history, they're continually intertwined. Now, to try and stage this encounter between David Harvey and some philosophers who were taking the geography seriously, we had a couple of workshops, one in Manhattan, Stony Brook's Manhattan campus, and one in Durham. And we talked about the project generally, we shared our knowledge about it, we sometimes shared our ignorance about it, and most of the contributors to the volume came to one or both of the conferences to talk about these ideas and bring this book together. And David Harvey came to the New York one on our invitation to meet these geographers who were taking to meet these philosophers who are taking the geography seriously. Now, the encounter didn't quite work as we'd hoped, but David's paper and a response by Ed Casey was included in the final volume. So there is this engagement between geography and philosophy that was intended there. And the final thing that we tried to do in the Reading Kant's Geography book was to discuss some of the racial issues in the lectures. And Robert Bernasconi, with us today, and Walter Mignolo and Eduardo Mendieta closed out the volume discussing those aspects. It was to try and think about that question of race in relation to the anthropology, in relation to lectures in the geography, and also a number of texts that Kant wrote on race at different times. To think about how the physical geography becomes a moral and a political geography. So what we tried to do is to show that in these workshops, but also in the volume that came out of them, the Reading Kant's Geography book, was that the geography was not a minor concern of Kant, but a central one throughout his career. That while much of the detail of the lectures may be outdated and of merely historical interest, Kant's way of structuring geography in relation to history and to geographical knowledge more generally was of enduring importance. To try to think about these kinds of questions and to try and work through their complexities was the aim of that book. The translation of the lectures in the Natural Science volume provides, I think, an opportune moment to take stock of them, but we wanted to have that sort of preface by this caution that what you're reading in the Natural Science volume, the physical geography in the Rink edition that's translated there, should come with a warning. It needs a caution to be alongside it. And the edited book, we hope, to provide a basis for making sense of those kinds of complexities and those issues. And as I said, it was a multidisciplinary project. It brought together geographers and philosophers, anthropologists, race studies people, German studies people, to try to think about these different aspects of the text from a range of different disciplines. And so the book sought to rise to that challenge of how a multi-handed, many-handed project could address those kinds of questions. And we are fortunate that Denny Schmidt's SUNY Press series in Contemporary Continental Philosophy got behind the project at an early stage. We'd actually received a very swift response from another press that we contacted, saying it wouldn't work. Quote, geographers are not interested in philosophy and philosophers are not interested in geography. Now, I thought at the time that was an erroneous judgment, and I still do. And I hope that the translation of the physical geography in the natural science volume will allow more conversations between these two disciplines. We felt that reading Kant's geography was a good example of what might be done with such conversations.